Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. China is what we talk about, and specifically the end of the one-child policy, which was announced fairly recently. Since the late 1970s, China has allowed urban couples to have one child and rural couples to have two, so long as their firstborn was a girl. I read differing things about this, but that's one of the things I've read. There's been a traditional preference for sons, so women have often aborted female fetuses. China's ratio now is 118 boys for every 100 girls. And we asked the question, why is it that China announced recently that it would start allowing every couple to have two children? And what have been the consequences of having a one-child policy for so many years? We have two guests who are joining us from the UK, actually, and they've been studying China for quite some time. Professor Stephanie Gordon is a researcher at the University of Leicester in the UK. She has studied China for more than 8 years, including 3.5 years living in various cities in China, and she speaks fluent Mandarin, and her expertise is the Chinese legal, political, and social field. Stephanie Gordon, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. And Dr. Ye Liu is also with us, a senior lecturer in international education at the Bath Spa. She's also a lecturer at the Contemporary Chinese Studies and director of the BA program in Chinese Studies at the University College in Cork, Ireland. And she is joining us as well this hour. Dr. Ye Liu, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Stephanie, let's start with you. Why did China announce this? What were the reasons?
Well, I think this is always a matter of when rather than if. It really wasn't a surprise. I mean, it's pretty common knowledge that China has an aging population and birthing restrictions were really unsustainable. But at the same time, this policy has been a legacy of the ruling party and it's not something that they could ever end overnight. We saw a couple of years ago the government actually introduced the two-child policy for parents who were single children themselves, if either one of the couple. So it's really quite a natural evolution.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about why Mao decided to do this. What were the reasons for it? The economy? They thought they'd build a stronger economy or what?
So essentially when it was introduced, I mean, this was after the death of Mao Zedong, but there had been campaigns in place by that time, like later, fewer, longer, preceding, before this policy was put in place. So that meant they were encouraging parents to get married and have children later, to have fewer children, and to wait longer between them. And this evolved into a two-child policy. And actually, it was this kind of idea that China could only support an optimal number of people that they actually decided to move to a one-child policy, which was based on predictions of rocket scientists, actually. So
really?
They had these predictions, yeah. Hmm. And they also, at the time, had very poor demographic data, so they really were guessing at what the population of China was at that time anyway. We know now, looking back, that actually the bulk of the reduction in births happened before the one-child policy.
Hmm.
So a lot of people say it actually didn't need to take place. But at the time, policymakers were worried. They thought, well, how can we economically advance, especially at the time the economy was opening up, as you said. So they were thinking, well, if we're going to economically advance, but we're going to have this out-of-control growing population, there's no way that China can move forward economically and increase the living standards of each citizen. So essentially, it maybe had some good intentions when it was introduced, but it was perhaps an ill-thought-out policy in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
This is really where it comes from, yeah.
Tell me more. Some of these things are fairly dramatic, Ye Liu, that there are a number of people who were unable to get, I don't know, birth certificates or get registered with the government that they had even been born because perhaps they were a second child and as a result couldn't go to school? Is that right?
Sorry?
Yes, I'm wondering about, we've read that some of the children, perhaps they were second births and they were not to be registered because you couldn't register if you had two children. As a result, they kind of slipped through the whole system that allowed people to get ID cards, that allowed people to go to school. Is that right?
I think it is the Farmer Stephanus paper article, and she did some analyse about what she argued is unrecorded children and the implications on their educational opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other thing that we have heard certainly is that there were forced sterilizations, that there were abortions, and that there were a number of people involved in government to enforce this policy. Was it as harsh as that?
I think it is. It was a ruthless social engineering, no doubt about it. And I think there has been a lot of debate about human rights and abortion and the negative consequence on women's birthright. But the unintended consequence of the one-child policy is the increasing opportunities for urban girls for their education, particularly their participation in higher education.
And that number went up quite significantly, didn't it, since the one-child policy?
When I compare the previous cohort and one-child cohorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when the one point that we really need to look at the socio-political circumstances, as Stephanie raised earlier, when the one-child policy was introduced. Indeed, the birth rate reduced before the one-child policy. However, we tend to forget about the size, the baseline size of the population. In 1978 was around 956 million, probably more than four times than that of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also it was after a disastrous economic planning and political campaigns and 10-year Cultural Revolution. So China was facing the major problem of overpopulation with a very low economic productivity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the socio-political, historical circumstances when the one-child policy was introduced. I think the very inconvenient truth behind all the debate is the issue of overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
Overpopulation is always at the heart of Chinese people. The American sociologist Barrington Moore argued in his book, it's called The Social Origin of Democracy and Dictatorship, and he argued overpopulation of rural peasants between the 18th and 19th century was one of the obstacles for China's transition to modernization and subsequent developments into communism in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And, overpopulation is still a pressing issue, not only for China, but for the whole world.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The world population is projected to reach 9.6 billion by 2050.
Mm-hmm.
The number estimated by United Nations. We are on the same planet where people are struggling for food and natural resources. So we need to put the issue of overpopulation in the context to understand the development of one-child policy.
Mm-hmm.
And not to forget that there are some positive consequences of this ruthless social engineering.
Mm-hmm. I have read somewhere, Stephanie, I wonder what you think about this, that even though there is a two-child policy now, that we may not see a large increase in the number of births in China, that people maybe have grown used to this and they're able to put their resources into one child and provide a great education, et cetera. Do you think that there will be a population boom?
Well, I think this really feeds into Leo's point. So firstly, I'll answer your question, but I think that really follows on with some of the points that Leo just made. So most China watchers have been very quick to point out that there won't be an increase, significant increase in birth rates. And I think this is a very simplistic way to look at the one-child policy because, as I already said, the decrease has already started before the one-child policy came in place.
Mm-hmm.
And it also warrants looking at broader demographic trends. So we know that every single country, as it develops economically and as the, you know, the economic and social welfare of the citizens go up, so too the birth rates go down. And you could say that it's a cycle, like having less children means that you can have a higher standard of living, and that means that you have less children. So, I mean, it's not only attributable to the one-child policy. If we look at other countries, say in the West or in Japan, you also see similar trends of an aging population. So the reason that some people say it won't go down is both because of the social precedent, but also because of broader demographic trends. And to feed into some of Yelio's point, what I wanted to say is that, I mean, I completely agree. Overpopulation, for most people, they would agree that it is something of a concern, but it's not an abstract figure in itself, and it's certainly the same with China. It's about resources. And while the Chinese government were concerned, at the same time, they didn't necessarily have good demographic data, and it also is about sustainability of resources, not a pure number within itself. And as I said anyway, we've seen this declining population not only because of the one-child policy, but because of economic policies opening up after Mao. And overpopulation really shouldn't be seen as in a vacuum, but it's part of a broader social good. So we need to have sustainable growth, but we also need to support an aging population. We also need to fulfill our duties to human rights. So I would be cautious whether this could excuse some of the implementation, which I'm sure Yelio wasn't saying, but we need to be careful how we balance this and how we see this in retrospect, whether the Chinese policymakers really were warranted in their actions or not. And it's a very delicate and complicated issue, of course, as Yelio pointed out.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear from people as you were in China, spending a lot of time doing interviews, living in various cities? Did you hear many complaints about this?
Absolutely. I actually did a lot of my research online in Chinese chat forums, and anyone who says there's censorship in China, which is completely true, but they really probably have never been onto Chinese chat rooms and QQ chats, which are the equivalent to Skype, but you can join many people together. And they're absolutely outright in their disgust about how the, you know, the people who have been affected. And as you actually brought up earlier about children being denied documentation, that was the focus of my research. And estimates, non-official estimates, put the number around the 2010 census around 30 million.
Oh, my
the
goodness.
Officials, yeah. Now, of course, you know, what's worth noting here is they wouldn't be without documentation their whole life. And this is why so few people have ever looked at this phenomenon. But we're talking about, you know, half the size of the UK, you know, in population terms. And they'll slowly filter back in as the parents can pay the fines, as they can get around, as they can bribe. Eventually, most of them will be registered and some won't. And as you said, they will be deprived of an education. They will face literally having no legal identity, no connection to the state. So this is, you know, a huge human rights issue that does need to be addressed. And even though the government has switched to a two-child policy, it, as far as we know, it won't work retroactively. So there are still many parents that I know. You know, I know this mother in Beijing. She earns £200-300 a month. That's $500 a month. And she has a fine for £30,000, which
oh,
is
$50,000.
She'll never afford it.
No.
Her son is 8. He can't go to school. She wanted to sell her kidney, but she was told she was too old.
Oh.
So, I mean, as you said, there are real consequences there, and people were very vocal about that. And one thing that I learned doing my research is that actually people came together. They came together on the internet. They would talk in forums at a provincial level, which is the same as a U.S. state, so quite a significant area. But also they would meet up and go and campaign in Beijing. They would politically mobilize. So another reason is, you ask, why did this end? Because there was huge, I can't say unrest because it would never be to the level of anything significant by the government standards, but it's significant enough that people can get together who don't know each other, who aren't from the community, to campaign against this.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about China's end of the one-child policy, how it came about, what has happened as a result of that policy, why they decided to end the policy. And we have two guests with us. Stephanie Gordon was just speaking. She's a researcher at the University of Leicester in the UK, has studied China for a number of years and spent 3.5 years living in various cities across China. Also, Ye Lu is with us, senior lecturer in international education at Bath Spa. She was also a lecturer of contemporary Chinese studies at the program in Chinese studies at the University College in Cork, Ireland, for a couple of years. What do you make of all of this? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. After yesterday's conversation about overpopulation, does it make you think that maybe the whole world needs to adopt a one-child policy which would help the planet? Or is it simply too large an infringement on human rights? We'll talk more about China's culture that seems to favor, maybe that's changed, boys rather than girls in the family. Has that changed at all? And whatever else you'd like to talk about. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls for China's the end of the one-child policy, 800-486-8655. Our number, and Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Enjoying your program as always.
Thanks.
I told Scott, it was good to hear him on the air yesterday. That was
good, good.
My question involves the history of Japan and recent history, and the time not that long ago when everybody was so sure that the great threat to the American economy was Japan, and Japan was going to surpass us and dominate the world. And then a funny thing happened. They ran into this exact same problem, aging population, and although they were trying to automate like crazy to stave it off, it caught up with them. There's still a strong economy, obviously, but they're certainly nowhere near the top of the heap where they once were. And this has been several years of this kind of a decline, and they weathered it, or I guess they are weathering it, but they also were a functioning democracy at the time. And my question is, if China goes through the same sort of a circumstance with their population aging, and that people's rising expectations are suddenly dashed with the same kind of a slump that Japan went into, how is this government going to handle it without a functioning democracy?
Interesting. Ye Lu, do you want to start?
I think it's a very interesting question. China is still a one-party state. It's still an authoritarian state. To be honest, I don't think the aging population would contribute to a rapid progression into a democratic political institution. The Chinese government is still primarily concerned about economic development, about their overall development strategy called overall strategy of development. So I think that's their main concern. The main reason to end the one-child policy is to balance the future, what we call the primary labor market, highly skilled labor, which means economic concern is still the party's priority. So I from my opinion, I cannot see the end of the one-child policy, and the aging population can be contributed to a rapid progression into democratic society.
Would you like to comment, Stephanie?
Yeah, I'm definitely following on from Yelio. Like, I don't think per se that China needs a democracy to handle an aging population. I mean, the pros and cons of democracy, I mean, we live in a democratic society and clearly favor that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it would be a more responsive way to handle situations like this in China, given that they don't have that democratic precedent right now. It's not to say they shouldn't have a democracy, but what I'm saying is it doesn't mean the government won't be able to handle the crisis, or if we say it's a crisis. To turn your attention to how China will handle the aging population, given what we know of Japan, I think that the situation will be very different. And as you said, everyone kind of thought that Japan was going to overtake the USA, and now they haven't, and what's going to happen with China? China doesn't have the same standard of living for all its population in the same way that Japan. So it's not a developed country. It's still developing, and there's still a huge amount of inequality. And as you point out, that could also stunt its growth, especially with regard to whether it will overtake the USA. So the question for me isn't will it become a larger economy than the USA, but what will that mean to the population within China? And I think the likelihood is that probably if they don't find a solution and they carry on with such inequality, this will have significant repercussions later on, and China won't be able to develop into a developed country with such inequality and an aging population to exacerbate this.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Yeah, well, I guess I would like to just a quick clarification. My understanding is that revolution and unrest have traditionally occurred not when people were really downtrodden, but when things were starting to improve and their level of expectations was growing. And I guess that's what I was really referring to, is that my feeling is that if you're a functioning democracy and you have that kind of a situation such as Japan faced, where people had that rising level of expectations and they were dashed, you at least have that outlet of, okay, we can vote the rascals out and we can get new rascals or whatever. But in a situation like this, if the Chinese people do find that their economy is cratering, that they are not enjoying the increasing standard of living that they have been getting used to, and they then start to turn on their leaders, their government, do you folks think the government reaction could be what? Mm-hmm. Would this be the severe crackdown? What kind of a response would that engender from this government? And I know I've taken up a lot of time here, so I'll get off.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Good questions. Ye Lu?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I think it's a very interesting point, but the Scott mentioned the social unrest occurred when the living standards are improving. But if we look at the history, the historical development of democracy and dictatorship, it's not entirely true. And particularly the American sociologist Benjamin Moore argued about the class relations in different, economic circumstances contributed towards the struggle, social unrest. So it's not entirely dependent on the improvement of living conditions. So that's I don't think there will be a massive crackdown when the economic growth fell below people's expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other political discourse, such as social harmony, particularly to promote this idea of we're the one family, despite we're from different ethnic backgrounds. So that's a really, really powerful ideology promoted by the Chinese Communist Party for social harmony. And also education, particularly higher education, was used continuously as an ideology of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you work hard, your parents pay for your higher education, you can have a degree, then, oh, you're on the way to upward social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
But that expansion of the higher education system actually played a very, very important role as implementing this idea of social harmony and upward social mobility. So I don't... the Chinese Communist Party is very good at using different discourse, Confucian discourse, you know, patriotic discourse to unite divided interests. So... I think they will try to develop different, implement different ideology rather than having this massive crackdown
mm-hmm.
of people's crackdown for social unrest.
Mm-hmm.
I would doubt that.
Let's talk about the education of women that has resulted from a one-child policy. I have read that we now have perhaps the most educated generation of women who are living in cities, and there is some concern with a change here with the fact that we still have a patriarchal society in China, that women could start losing out on careers and promotions and perhaps going into higher education, because if you're going to educate one child, and if you have a boy and a girl, the boy would take preference. Is there any truth in that, Stephanie?
Well, this is really more Yulio's area of expertise than mine. What I would say is that, yes, there is some compelling data to indicate that the one-child policy has benefited a certain subsection of women, but we need to look at this broadly. I mean, there is still a disparity between urban and rural areas, so it might benefit single children in urban areas, but it might not have had the same benefit for women in rural areas who possibly still wouldn't have had access to education, who possibly would have suffered because they wanted to have more children and faced kind of mandatory sterilization and these kind of things. So it's all something in balance. As I said, it's not my area of expertise, but I can see that there is an argument to be made there. But I think also at the same time, China's come a very long way from when the one-child policy was implemented. You still have a patriarchal society broadly in the countryside, which means that the daughter, when they get married, they go to live with the husband and the family. But in cities, things have changed and evolved, and it means that there's also been a change of ideas. So I personally, from my own data, my findings, I don't think that that would happen in the cities. I don't think that parents who have two children would suddenly say, oh, we're not sending the daughter to university. I think things have really moved beyond that. But maybe Ye Liu had found different things to me.
What do you say, Ye Liu?
From my research, because I've been interviewing girls and boys from one-child families and those who are non-one-child families. I do find particularly urban girls have very high aspirations, and particularly when they enter higher education, they're very strategic about their learning, about their career planning. They're very ambitious. In my article in the conversation, I just raised the concern about this. This is probably the most educated Chinese women over the whole over this generation, one child generation,
mm-hmm.
and they're in their mid thirties now. Okay, so once the one child policy is relaxed, this particular generation, what we call the Balingho post-80s, they're under greater pressure to to have another child.
Right.
Okay. I've been following closely on the Chinese social media, like Xinjiang Weibo and WeChat, and a lot of women, Baling Ho, belong to this particular birth cohort. The kind of joke, okay, the under one child policy, but I'm happy it's not compulsory. So I really doubt urban women with a proper career wanted to have another child, because the China doesn't really have a very strong welfare provision.
Mm-hmm.
Maternity leave, the conditions of maternity leave were appalling, and childcare was very expensive, particularly in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all this social policy, were not developed to match this expectation of having more than one child.
Mm-hmm.
In urban areas.
And tell me more about the child care and compare the urban and the rural areas when it came to child care. Are there a lot of centers in major cities? And how expensive, when you say it's expensive, how expensive?
In the big cities like Beijing, Shanghai, child care can be very, very expensive, particularly for middle-class families, professional families. For the rural areas, because rural children, there has been a larger proportion of what we call the leftover children, whose parents went to city to seek for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
To seek for jobs. So these children left behind, and these children were looked after by their grandparents. So the childcare, the cost of childcare. Is massively different for rural family and for urban family.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about China saying you can now have more than one child. It's the end of the one-child policy in China, and our guests have been studying the history of the one-child policy and what this will mean for people who are living in China now, for women, many of whom have benefited as a result of the one-child policy because money has been put into their educations and into their careers. So we're looking at the history. If you have any questions about how this policy was enforced, how it has changed, what you think about the change, we certainly welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. We have two guests with us. Dr. Ye Liu is Senior Lecturer in International Education at Bath Spa. She's also taught at the University College Cork in Ireland. Stephanie Gordon is a researcher at the University of Leicester in the UK, and she has spent a number of years living in various cities all over China. What do you think of this policy? Were you appalled when China announced such a policy? And what do you think about how it was enforced? Is it because of overpopulation in many countries on Earth an environmental issue for other countries to perhaps enact one-child policy? Our guest yesterday was saying that we should have, 1.5 children, everybody on Earth? We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more, Stephanie, about the enforcement of the one-child policy. You have said that from forced abortions, sterilization, and astronomical fines, it led to a plethora of human rights abuses. And you also have studied how many people had to work at this. I mean, tens of thousands of people in one province alone to enforce the policy.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, you have to remember why this policy has taken so long to be, phased out, is that a lot of people's livelihoods depend on it. So that means that at each province, they're going to write this into their legislation, and at each level of government, this has been a really important factor. So we have people who work in the medical care, health care, through contraception, through enforcement and monitoring of fertility and how many women are getting pregnant. We have, you know, people employed by the agency to ensure that parents are paying fines. And we also have money going back in to fuel the system. So that means that the fines that parents were paying because they had children without permission, that was going back into local governments, and this didn't even need to be disclosed how the money was being spent.
Mm.
So what I'm saying is that you have this whole bureaucracy whereby you find that it's a self-sustaining, where millions of people are employed and they depend on this. It's like any industry, the government would be very cautious about phasing this out.
So what will all those people do now in terms of jobs?
Well, it hasn't gone away. This is the point. I mean, China is still limited to children, and also there will always be the need for the other things that come with it, like some positives, we could say, access to contraception, for example, family planning, education. So not everything in this bureaucracy was bad, and we should remember that it certainly hasn't disappeared. So families who want three children, but also single mothers, it's effectively illegal to be a single mother in China. And
really?
If you are, you're charged in the same way as if you have too many children.
Mm.
So, and you could also be denied the legal identity documentation for your child. And this is a problem I saw in Beijing and beyond, that many single mothers were struggling for years to have their children recognized. There's no indication from the government that this is going away.
So is there a movement to change that status for single moms or not?
There have been in the media and from different academics and different kind of people in high profiles, there have been calls to abolish this. There have been changes in certain provinces to allow parents to register their children no matter whether they've paid the fine or not. There have been similar provisions for single mothers. And because China is so big and there's so much variation province to province, I guess a little bit similar to the States, not exactly, but there is a latitude of freedom. This means that, yes, there have been some improvements. But it's not uniform. And actually, what I found in Beijing, where the strictest implementation really is, some mothers have really, really suffered, and they've campaigned hard to get this changed, and they're still fighting that battle.
And what will the fine be now if you have three children or more?
Well, again, that will depend on where you live, and the fines have always been proportional to your income. So fines typically for having a second child without permission, it would depend on what province you're in, but it would also depend if you're having, for example, an extramarital affair, you'll get charged more. But it could be 4 to 8 times your family income or family disposable income. So let's say your family earns $50,000, you could pay a fine of $200,000 and you'd have to pay that in 3 years. So it's very substantial, but the point is that it's a burden for everyone, rich or poor, because it's proportional to what you earn, unless you can bribe an official and get around it somehow, which also does happen. So I would say that what's quite likely is local governments have depended on this money, on this revenue, is that while they will now allow two children, they might punish very harshly having three children to generate that income.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet. It's all speculation. So we'll have to wait and see how it's implemented, but that wouldn't surprise me.
Mm. I know that you also, Ye Lu, have done a number of interviews with women, singleton, you call them singleton women and singleton men at various universities across East China. I'm wondering what they thought about being only children. Did they miss not having a brother or a sister? Did they lament that they may have to be the ones caring for their parents and maybe in some cases their parents and grandparents?
That's the genuine concern for the whole, what we call one-child cohort. Their main concern is how to look after their parents and their grandparents, because this is what we call 4-to-1 family. four grandparents, two parents, one child.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their main concern. And the most circulated media articles in the Chinese social media is about the sad story of the one child generation, and they have to earn more money to look after their parents.
Yes, right.
And they have to follow the well-worn path of living close to their family, had to, you know, this kind of expectation on them for the parents, grandparents in later age. So that's a very, very, you know, genuine concern over this whole cohort.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely true.
How did the Chinese government announce this policy to everybody? Was it just a statement made? Was it in the newspapers? How did people find out?
It's a kind of a worst kept secret. there has been speculation about the end of a one-child policy for a couple of years, and it was announced in the Communist Party annual conference, I think three weeks ago. It became public after the as one of the conference, what we called results. But everyone was expecting the end of the one-child policy. It's sooner or later, but it's worst kept a secret.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes official, Stephanie, in 2016, right?
That's what we're told. But again, we need to remember how policy actually gets implemented in China. It gets written into legislation at a national level, but then again at provincial levels. So, for example, last time when there were relaxations, there was a lag time between when it became official, according to national policy, and then when each province had actually written it into their legislation. And what you found is up until the point that that province had released their legislation, the policy wasn't actually active yet. So we still have parents who were entitled to having two children being fined anyway. So again, this will be a challenge facing the Chinese government in 2016, is actually ensuring that all provinces implement this in a timely measure and don't delay. And again, we don't know exactly the ins and outs and nuts and bolts of exactly how everything will be implemented. So it's still something that we have to wait and see and actually look at how the implementation takes place, because as we know, in China, it's such a big country with so much latitude for local governments to take the government legislation. So it's always a question of, well, what is the legislation, but what is actually happening on the ground, and what is actually going on, and what is actually being implemented in this place and that place, and then we really get a good idea of what's going on.
Well, both of you have been on the ground. Stephanie, what did you find out? Were people, when they had the one-child policy, and were people cheating in any ways and helping each other out?
Absolutely. I think, as I said, well, there's a lot of latitude in how policies are implemented. Mm-hmm. That also gives a great scope for corruption, right? So what you see is that people would hide their children. They would ask their brother or sister or cousin to register their child as their own. They would have two children close on to, and that between, with a little gap between them, and then register them as twins. They would bribe a local official. They would go to another province. There's so many ways to get around it. Now, I'm not minimizing the impact it had on so many people, but I'm saying that, you know, people are smart, and they'll always find ways around whenever they can. And in China, when you have the difference in implementation in different places, well, certainly people are going to take advantage of that. And that's also a really interesting thing to look at. And really it comes down to, while the policy affects rich and poor alike, obviously richer people have better contacts. They have friends in high places.
Right.
They can pull a few strings. I mean, and likewise in the poorer villages where people have no money, well, how can you implement it if people can't pay? So sometimes you have to just turn a blind eye. But as we talked about before, about children not getting registered, well, this is one of the consequences. The government said, well, I can't do anything. This person has two kids now, and they have no money to pay. But if I don't give that kid a document, they won't exist on paper, right? Like, mm-hmm. the government will never know they're there.
Mm-hmm.
So the government doesn't get told off in that local area for not implementing the policy. The parent doesn't get told off. But the long-term impact on the child is quite clear. So this is another reason why we have children who don't have legal identities. It's so that people don't need to get punished and they can get around these kind of harsh implementations.
Would you like to comment on this, Yelu?
Absolutely. I agree with Stephanie. I think people have a lot of ways of getting around the one-child policy, and particularly for rich couples, they had the financial resources to pay the fines. Of course, it punished the poor rural families. But another issue kind of overlooked in the discussion is actually one-child families were given certain kind of benefits monthly. So if the families follow the one-child policy, both parents were given in the 1980s, they were given 5 yuan per month.
Mm-hmm. Is that a lot?
As long as they show the one-child certificate.
Yeah.
At that time, it mattered, because 5 yuan per month, you know, you could buy a lot of rice.
Yes.
With that little kind of contribution towards their salary. So a lot of people, particularly if they work as civil servants or if they work in the cities, urban areas, as teachers, for example, doctors or civil servants, they follow the one-child policy quite, you know, religiously, and they had some financial incentive
mm-hmm.
to do that. Yeah.
So will both of you be heading to China in 2016, or do you need a year or so to go by to figure out how this new policy is going to work? Stephanie?
It's not in my plans right now, I have to admit. I'm pregnant, and I'm planning on having a baby, so going to China isn't top of my priority. But I do hope that later on I will be able to go back and get in touch with the people I studied and see how they've ended up and whether they've been able to sort out their situation.
Yes.
And I think it will be very interesting later on looking at how this affects larger families, how this affects single mothers, how it affects people who, you know, transgressed the policy prior to this change, because, as I said, there's no indication that they'll be granted amnesty. So I think there's still a lot to look out for. But, yeah, again, social change will come, and it just is a matter of time.
Yeah. How about you, Yelu?
Yes, I actually did a very quick survey among my contacts, the students I interviewed in 2007. I kept in touch with mm-hmm. them on social media, the QQ, and I just sent a very quick message and asked them, because most of them started families now in Zhejiang and Anhui. And the most girls said no, and some of them said they will consider whether to have another child. So it's something quite unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
As Stephanie pointed out, it will take quite a few years to be implemented across the whole country, and there is a geographical variation in terms of implementing policy. So I'm definitely going back to China in 2016.
Great.
And hopefully I will have more data.
Okay. Let us know what you find. Our thanks very much to Dr. Yelu, Senior Lecturer in International Education at Bath Spa. Stephanie Gordon, all the best with a new baby, too. A researcher at the University of Leicester talking about China's changing its one-child policy. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening.